This week on Pop of Culture, we go on summer adventures. We'll look up at the night sky.
Kind of. You can actually take a pair of binoculars in here with that technology and see things in more detail, just like the real sky.
We'll boat down a river teeming with alligators.
Sort of.
And although alligators always look pretty menacing, these ladies look pissed.
And we'll craft a quilt.
Well, we'll talk to someone who does.
That's coming up in this encore edition of Pop of Culture.
Support for Pop of Culture comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and from you. Become a sustaining member of IPR and support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
From IPR, this is Pop of Culture. I'm Jen Blackmer.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. Our show is off this week, enjoying some extra holiday time. So we're going to listen back to some of our favorite interviews.
As we look forward to warm summer nights, a la John Travolta.
Yes, love that.
We thought we'd look up to the night sky.
I am sitting underneath the stars with Dana Thompson. Well, sort of. We are in the Ball State University Charles W. Brown Planetarium, and I am with Dana Thompson, who is the director here. This is, I feel like my voice has to be like a little softer because it's really dark in here, Dana, and the stars are beautiful. There's constellations. There's the Milky Way. What an amazing place to be, right?
Absolutely. It is amazing. And yeah, it does feel like you kind of have to whisper in here. Sound travels very oddly. We are in this interesting shaped room. It's curved. We have this curved ceiling. It's a dome ceiling, so we can project onto it the night sky and make it look realistic. So sound does get focused here in interesting ways, but we try not to put anyone to sleep too much with our calm voices, even though I'm told I have a calm voice, a relaxing voice.
Yes.
I've narrated our meditation program, actually, in a very soothing way.
Yeah.
But we do try to also have some energy behind it as well.
Yeah. Well, it is just beautiful. I love coming here. I've been coming here for quite a while, and I understand with the new building, you're celebrating quite a milestone.
Yeah. 10 years since we opened to the public in the Charles W. Brown Planetarium. But before that, we had an older, original planetarium that serviced the community for 47 years.
47 years.
Yeah.
That is a long time. And I understand, is this the largest dome in Indiana?
Yeah, this is the largest planetarium in Indiana here at Ball State University. We have a 16-meter dome. It's about 52 and a half feet. It's about 2 feet larger than the planetarium dome at Notre Dame, actually.
Yes.
So we did get a little bit larger of a dome by 2 feet than Notre Dame's. And yeah, we opened 10 years ago this month to the public.
How long have you been here, Dana, and what drew you to this type of work?
I have been at Ball State University since 2010 when I started as a graduate student in the Department of Physics and Astronomy when I was a master's student there. I actually got my master's degree in physics from Ball State. So it took me 2 years to do that. And while I was doing that, I got my experience, my first experience inside a planetarium as a graduate assistant working at the planetarium, the older original planetarium here. And that was a smaller 30-foot dome in the basement. We tend to joke that Boy Scout groups are still lost in the basement of the building trying to find that planetarium because it was hidden.
Yes.
This new one is attached to the side of the building. So it is something that you can see from the outside. It is domed from the outside, and you know that it is a room for space, basically, for space exploration, to study the stars, to study the night sky. So while I was a graduate student, I was studying the night sky. guy in the classroom, and then I had school groups come to the planetarium, and I was able to share what I learned in the classroom with them in an interesting and engaging way. And that was really exciting because I was able to just have fun with the science, with the knowledge. Mm-hmm. And there is no test in the planetarium. It wasn't a intimidating space. Yeah. We just could have fun learning together as a group, as a team, basically. And that really drew me to the science communication part of mm-hmm. science and STEM.
Were you interested in the night sky as a kid?
When I was growing up, I did have a really good view of the night sky because I grew up in the middle of cornfields. Ah. And then those cornfields turned into subdivisions. Mm-hmm. So my sky quality where I was got a little worse. However, I didn't really know my constellations until I was teaching them. And I learned more about the sky, learned more about constellations. And I feel like when you know more about something, you can get more interested in the subject, more passionate about it. And that's what really drew me to it, is knowing a little bit more about it and getting more excited about it. Growing up, my dad was really excited about astronomy, though. Mm. He would have a telescope and he would set it out to things and say, come out and look at it. And we'd kind of begrudgingly go and look at the telescope and say, yeah, that's cool, Dad. Okay, can we go back inside? But now actually sharing it with people and, again, knowing more information about the objects rather than it just being this kind of abstract thing in the sky is really interesting. So learning about it in a planetarium and then going out and seeing it in the real sky is really exciting for our guests, which we do. We have these public programs on the weekends, Fridays and Saturdays, where they learn about the content. And then afterwards, if the weather is nice and if the time of day is right, then we can share that with them in the real sky and point a telescope and have them see the object with a real telescope, which is really great.
That is really great. We're looking at like a lot of different constellations in the sky. How many are there?
There are 88 constellations, 88 official constellations marked by the International Astronomical Union. Mm-hmm. 88 constellations, the same as the number of keys on a standard piano, if that helps you remember it.
That's interesting. Yep. As we look up there at them now, what do you have a favorite story behind one of them?
Yeah, that's a common question, is if I have a favorite constellation or a favorite planet.
Yeah.
And I tend to joke that we're not really supposed to have favorites. It's just like children. You're not supposed to have a favorite planet. I do have some that I am a little bit nostalgic around, yeah, or I have good memories about. And that's the constellation Cygnus the Swan. I really like Cygnus the Swan. One, it looks like what it's supposed to look like. not a lot of constellations do.
Right, right.
So, for instance, we're looking at Orion the Hunter up in the sky, and I can point to it with my red arrow and explain it to the folks. So we have these two stars that mark his shoulders,
yes,
three stars in a row for his belt here.
Yeah.
And his little sword off of his belt, kind of this string of stars below that belt.
Yeah.
And then two stars for his feet or knees, depending on how you draw him. He has this shield out in front of him, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can see with good imagination maybe what we're seeing here, all this detail. But most people just see the stick figure in the mm-hmm. sky. And that's great. That's wonderful for a constellation. Not a lot of constellations look like this. For instance, right next to Orion the Hunter in the sky, just to the left of him in the sky from our perspective here, is this constellation of a unicorn, Monoceros. And we look behind this overlay, this picture of this beautiful unicorn, mm-hmm. and there's like nothing in the sky, no bright stars. And they say, you wonder, how did they get that, right?
Yeah.
I think someone just really wanted a unicorn constellation in the sky, right?
I mean, who wouldn't want a unicorn in the sky, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I get it.
So Cygnus the Swan, you can actually make a swan out of, and unfortunately we don't see it right now in the sky. It is more of a summertime constellation. It's actually a part of the asterism, this recognizable group of stars in the sky. We call those asterisms. They're not official constellations in the sky. But it's a part of the asterism called the summer triangle. It's up all the time in the summer. So we have Cygnus the Swan. It has this cross shape for its long body and then the cross beam for its wings, and they actually go out and extend even farther. And so it does look like a swan in the sky.
Okay.
And it actually, if you can see the Milky Way, this band of light going across the sky, the galaxy that we live in made of hundreds of billions of stars, and our sun is just part of it. The Swan constellation actually looks like it's flying in the Milky Way. So that's really cool. And also, the beak of the swan is called Alberio. And Alberio, with a telescope, with the help of a telescope, you can actually see that it's not just one star, like it looks like in the sky, but it's actually two. And with the telescope, you can see that it's a bright blue star. Ooh. Right next to a gold, like yellow-orange star. Wow. In the sky. So you can see the color of those two. And that's one of the first stars I really learned how to point a telescope to. It's one of the first constellations I learned besides the popular ones like Orion and Ursa Major, the Big Bear. So there's a lot of things with Cygnus that's really interesting. And there's a really popular black hole in Cygnus, this one, called Cygnus X1. There's a whole bunch of really great things.
That is a lot in one constellation. That, no wonder you like to tell that story. That's amazing. I didn't realize that there were so many different color variations for the stars.
Yeah, absolutely. I can actually bring up a quick picture.
Okay.
So this picture is a picture of a star cluster. It's one that we usually bring up with our school children, and this is kind of the first really dynamic things that we bring up. And it just blows their minds, and they think it looks like fireworks because it does. It's this picture of a whole group of stars that are all different colors. There's blue and red and yellow and orange and white. No green or pink stars. That would be really cool, but there's not any in this picture. But we have this range of colors of stars, and we can talk about star temperature with this picture, with the young kids that come through our planetarium.
Yes.
And so they see this, and we talk about temperature and light, and that the color is telling us information. Like the blue stars are very hot stars, and the red stars are the least hot. Still very hot. All stars are very, very hot, but the blue stars are the hottest, and the red stars are the least hot.
It's the opposite of what you would think.
Exactly. Yeah. So we say it's opposite from what your faucets say at work or home or school or what have you.
It's beautiful. And there's so many. It literally is a blanket of color. It's just, I wish our listeners could see it right now. Even more reason to come to the planetarium, right? How many children, like school groups, come through here every year on average?
Yeah, every year we get about 10,000 school children visiting the planetarium. So about 200 groups total.
Wow. And they are from all over East Central Indiana and beyond, because this is, I mean, where else are you going to go for a planetarium like this, right?
Yeah, we get a lot of school children from, of course, Muncie, but surrounding communities as well, as far as Indianapolis. And we've even had groups from Ohio come.
Wow. Talk a little bit about the shows, not just for school children, but for families that you offer on the weekend. Talk about the different types of programming the planetarium offers.
Yeah, of course. We have public programs on the weekends, Fridays and Saturdays. We have shows typically at 6:30 on Fridays. And then on Saturdays, we have a 3:30 family-friendly show. So that's things like our Sesame Street show that's really popular. We have a Magic Treehouse program that's pretty new, very, very popular. We just got a new program that is about accidental astronauts, basically these kid astronauts that go to the moon. That's a nice new family program that we have that we're premiering next year.
Oh, nice.
We have programs about sending humans to Mars for the first time and about our new James Webb Space Telescope. So we have the new James Webb Space Telescope out in space taking beautiful pictures. We just did a whole program about that that was original to Ball State University, completely live and interactive. Then we have other kind of pre-recorded programs, movies about finding life on other planets, about the birth of our solar system and Earth, about how astronomers do science, basically a whole range.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love it that you create programs in-house. Talk a little bit about, you know, when that started and how that feels to create something here at the planetarium.
Yeah, so we've been creating planetarium programs at Ball State for many, many years before the Charles W. Brown Planetarium was actually created, as far back as the old planetarium. Our previous director, Dr. Ron Kachuk, would create programs and put them together for the older planetarium. And then that inspired me when I came in to create my own shows from looking at what he did and building from that. And so when we had the new planetarium put in, we were able to do more. We have this new technology, this full dome technology that allows us to project onto the entire planetarium dome these movies and images. It's kind of like an IMAX theater in a way. And fortunately for us, it's very powerful and allows us to go to different planets, different parts of our universe, and see things in a lot of detail. For instance, exploring Saturn's rings. So that was actually the first planetarium program I created. We had Saturn and Beyond, and that was created only about a year or so after we had the Brown Planetarium open, which is a very short time for a show creation. Usually it takes about 2 years or so to create a full-length program for planetarium. And so Saturn and Beyond was our first production, and it was the first one that we were able to declare intellectual property with at Ball State and sell and distribute to other planetariums around the world. Then we've also partnered with other departments on productions. We have our Halloween program that we partnered with the IDIA Lab, the Department of Anthropology, and the Department of Theater and Dance, because one of the students from Theater and Dance actually came and narrated the program for us.
That's very cool. So we are now sitting behind, do you have a name for this? But like the command station?
We are sitting behind this control panel and this console, basically. We usually call it a console, but it's this whole control panel. There's a whole bunch of buttons and knobs and sliders. There's an iPad. Actually, there's two iPads that control the system. It controls our audio. It can actually also control our entire planetarium software from anywhere in the dome. So that allows us to present in front of the audience if we ever wanted to, which we do for school groups so we can really engage with them up close. But you can see that the control panel here, it has these numbers for our date, and it is kind of like a DeLorean screen, and you can actually punch in any date plus or minus 10,000 years and the planetarium system will take you there. It's just for pretend though, right? But it will take you there, and it'll show you what the sky actually looked like back 10,000 years ago and 10,000 years into the future. Beyond that, the mathematics for showing where the planets will be and the moon will be, those positions, those very detailed positions, kind of breaks down plus or minus 10,000 years. But then we can also do more with our digital system, because we have this unique hybrid system here. And with our digital system, we can actually show the sky tens of thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years into the future, and show actually what we call proper motion in the sky, which means that the stars that make up the constellations, they're all moving in the galaxy, and they shift ever so slightly in the sky. But over long periods, you can actually see that shift in the sky and see constellations kind of morph into new shapes. So the Big Dipper might not actually be the Big Dipper in about 100,000 years. It'll be a little wonky. So if I speed up time by hundreds of thousands of years, you can actually see those stars shift. And then back to today. And then back in time. And so a little while ago, I was talking about the Northern Cross. And that makes up or helps make up the Swan constellation, Cygnus, the Swan, here in the sky. And so if I go forward in time, you can see that in
That's the far future. Different wingspan.
It is a very different wingspan. Yes, for sure.
Talk a little bit about the giant purple behemoth in the center of the room that kind of makes all of the magic happen, right?
We have this big purple thing in the middle of the room, and that is our star projector. the star projector. That means it projects or puts up tiny little points of light all on our curved ceiling, our dome ceiling in here. And it makes it look like nighttime, even though it's daytime outside. So some people come in and they say it's a camera or a telescope. It is kind of like that, but not really. It is a projector. Mm-hmm. And it can put up about 4,000 of the brightest stars.
Wow.
That we make our constellations out of. And it can fill in the Milky Way with 10 million points of light representing stars. You can actually take a pair of binoculars in here with that technology and see things in more detail. Just like the real sky, because it has a resolution equivalent to 70K, 70K, because it uses gears, lenses, LED lights, and more to mm-hmm. put up the sky. It's not a digital projector. It's an optomechanical projector. It's an analog projector. So it's not limited to digital pixels or that kind of technology.
Oh.
And then on either side of that purple guy in the middle, mm-hmm. we have two fisheye projectors. Those are digital projectors, and those put up things like movies and pictures in here.
Gotcha.
And that is put up with really great resolution still at 4K. So it's 4K versus 70K, though. So far, we've only been really seeing the digital projection. And if we switch over now that we've been in here for a while, you can see the other projection here, which does look, in my opinion, much more realistic.
Yes.
And this is what a lot of planetariums do not have. They do not have this kind of a sky quality anymore because a lot of planetariums are going to digital technology.
It's so beautiful. I feel like I need to have my sleeping bag and like a cup of cocoa and yeah. like a little fire going. It's just beautiful.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. And we get a lot of oohs and ahs in here. Yeah. And I think that, you know, that's what we try to do in here is we get that reaction and we have that suspension of disbelief in here where they feel like they're looking at the real sky. And the old planetarium, the previous director, he said that one time someone actually thought they opened the planetarium dome and were looking at the real sky. And we have very similar technology, actually better technology now here in the new planetarium than the previous planetarium.
It really does give you that feel that it just opened up and you're getting this once in a lifetime view.
And I think that it's really powerful having this experience in a room full of people. We sometimes, unfortunately, have to turn people away because there's so many people who want to come out to our shows. We see 152. And so you're surrounded by people who want to learn alongside with you, who want to experience this with you. And so there's that community aspect as well.
Yes.
You're not just walking to your car after work, looking up at the sky, thinking it's beautiful, and being alone in that. You are with other people and enjoying it alongside family and friends.
Oh, that's such a good point. Is that one of the things that you love the most about what you do, Dana? What is it that you love the most?
I love the connection in the planetarium, how we can connect with the audience, how mm-hmm. it's a two-way conversation with them, never a lecture, never this one-way conversation where I'm talking at them. I love when we have this audience participation and reaction, and we do have that. We have a lot of audience members actually respond to any kind of activities we give them, any tasks we give them in the planetarium, whether it's finding a planet in the sky together as a group or a constellation together as a group. We're all in this together under this planetarium sky. And that kind of connection is really powerful, especially in the planetarium.
Well, Dana, thank you so much for hanging out under the stars with Pop of Culture today.
Yeah, thank you so much, Michelle. It was wonderful.
I can't believe I got through the whole thing without a single space pun.
Dana Thompson is the director of the Charles W. Brown Planetarium in Muncie. We spoke to her in 2024. It's Pop of Culture. I'm Michelle Kinsey.
And I'm Jen Blackmer. We're listening back to some of our favorite pieces this week. And one thing that's delighted us this season is our collaboration with River Teeth. River Teeth is a biannual journal of nonfiction narrative. That means creative essays that draw on the writer's personal experiences, often crossing the divide between stories and poetry. River Teeth Journal has a weekly online magazine called Beautiful Things, full of what the journal calls micro-essays. We first heard the following essay in April. We are speaking with writer and instructor at Brevard College, Lindsay Farr. Hello, Lindsay. Welcome to our program.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Where are you joining us from?
I am in my little cabin outside of Asheville, North Carolina.
And when you say little cabin, is it a little cabin? I mean, is it kind of in the middle of nowhere?
Literally in a little cabin and kind of in the middle of nowhere. It's not quite an A-frame. It's rickety and glorious, and I've lived in it for 5 years now.
That sounds fantastic, actually, especially for a writer. It seems like it would be a great place to do your work.
It is.
Well, speaking of your work, tell us a little bit about it. What types of things do you write?
Interestingly enough, I really, in my heart of hearts, I want to write fiction, but I never can quite get over how strange life is. And so I found myself writing creative nonfiction and loving it. I love the membrane between it and poetry. I feel like it mimics the way my brain works.
Absolutely. And the great thing about this particular segment in our collaboration with River Teeth is that's what River Teeth focuses on, is creative nonfiction. And that sort of blending of genres, as you say, between poetry and essay and observations. And tell us about the piece you're going to share with us today. It's called We Call Up Danger Only to Send It Away.
Yes. So this little micro essay was found, it went through several different iterations until it found its truest form, distilled down into this micro essay. And it's a scene from my early 20s, I would say, in my hometown of Jackson, Mississippi.
Awesome. All right. Well, let's hear it. This is Lindsay Farr's essay, We Call Up Danger Only to Send It Away.
I can call them, you know. Call who? The Gators. Bull. In response, Joe lifted the trolling motor with one tattooed arm. Then he winked at me and started making these beeping noises in the back of his throat. No sound floated on the Pearl River but the whine of mosquitoes and Joe's Space Invader laser chirps. I watched the black water for movement, my lukewarm beer forgotten. Nothing. A fish jumped. Far off bumps broke the glassy surface and cruised towards us. Then more bumps. Then more. Like a stealthy flotilla of logs or alligators. Only females respond to the chirps made by their hatchlings, and although alligators always look pretty menacing, these ladies look pissed. Soon, we were surrounded by a dozen alligators, all over 6 feet long. I found myself acutely aware of just how tiny this little bass boat was, how thin its sparkly red fiberglass hull. Joe beamed at me. The gator's eyes peered up at us, unblinking. Now what? I asked. You wanted to see some alligators. Now you want them to go away? Make up your mind, baby girl. He lit a Marlboro and exhaled, smiling down at the gators indulgently as if each one was his precious, deadly baby. He looked the same way at me sometimes. I was the closest thing to a daughter he ever got. Then he reached down with his palm and slapped the water hard. Every pair of eyes disappeared, returning the surface to glass once more.
Wow. Oh, Lindsay, that was awesome.
Thank you.
I think the thing that I responded to as I was listening. There were two things, actually, but the first thing I want to talk about is the suspense this builds up, right? I think there's several details where you are talking about, you know, the glassy eyes looking up and then the boat feeling really small.
Yeah, it was, I remember like just pulling away from the side of the boat, like that's going to do any good.
Right. And then this, you wanted to see some alligators and here they are. The other thing that is quite impactful about this is the level of detail that puts us in the middle of this scene. And it really, you're using so much sensory detail that I'm feeling the humidity and I'm hearing the conversation and the stuff in the background. And then you say he lit a Marlboro and it's and I'm just so there. Your use of detail is really compelling.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. How do you do that? Do you just, as you're working on the piece, do you just recall what you were thinking about? Do you try and put yourself back there? Yeah. How did you do it?
I mean, this scene is etched onto my soul forever. It was that memorable. And also it's, I find that when we have memories that we treasure, you know, sometimes we can pull them out and look at them and roll them around in our palms until they become kind of dulled. And so I find that writing short creative nonfiction to be kind of a gift to my own memory, in that here it is in its most concentrated crystalline form, and it will never be dulled. I can't forget it now.
Right. That's lovely and very true. And one of the interesting things you do here as well is give us the memory in its kind of contradictory form too, right? That it's not like you just want to gloss it over and say, oh, this was a lovely day. That in fact, you know, it was a small boat and you're surrounded by, quote, ladies who look pissed, unquote, right? And it's a gorgeous memory, but it's also kind of precarious, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're surrounded by alligators looking at you like, okay, where are the babies?
Yeah, I know, and like your lunch, right? What happened next? Am I allowed to ask that? I don't know if I'm allowed to ask that. What happened next?
Yeah, I mean, like when it was kind of amazing, like there's that everything, time kind of stopped for a second, you know, and the violence of the gesture when he like reached down and just popped.
Yeah. You
know, flat-handed the top of the water, and they literally vanished.
Oh, which is fascinating and creepy at the same time, because you know they're still there, right?
You know, and then we just, you know, he put the trolling motor back in the water and off we went, you know?
Yeah. Wow. What, Lindsay, what are you working on now?
That's a great question. What I'm working on now is I did a residency in a dune shack outside of Provincetown, Massachusetts, out in Cape Cod. Mm-hmm. And so I am going through a lot of the kind of sketches that I ended up doing up there and fleshing those out. So right now I'm writing a thing about humpback whales and how they have lungs the size of Priuses.
Yeah. And I'm getting a theme here, which is sort of water life, you know, and that, and it's weird. I mean, there's the division between life in the water and life on land, and we encounter them. And, you know, what is that about? Priuses, lungs the size of Priuses.
That's what, you know, I was on one of those whale watching tours, and they had the a naturalist on board telling you all of these facts, you know, about the whales around you. And they're like, yeah, their lungs are the size of Priuses. I was like, that's such a strange Compelling comparison.
Strange comparison, and yet it's specific. And here we are talking about it. That's great. Lindsay Farr is a writer and an instructor at Brevard College. She lives in a cabin in the woods, which I would love to be able to do. And she shared her beautiful thing with us. We call up danger only to send it away here on Pop of Culture. Lindsay, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.
This story comes from IPR's collaboration with River Teeth's Beautiful Things, a weekly magazine of micro essays. More at riverteethjournal.com.
It's our regular What Are You Working On segment time. This week, we're listening back to art quilter Darren Redman. Our co-host, Kara Duquette, takes it from here.
Darren Redman is a 2D and 3D textile artist who says her art is about sharing life's journey. So thank you so much for taking the time to share a little journey with us today, Darren.
Well, thanks for having me.
You've done a lot of quilting art across Indiana, and today I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your work in East Central Indiana, and I was wondering if you could tell us about a recent show that you had at the Anderson Museum of Art.
Yes, the Anderson Museum of Art asked me to hang some of my art quilts. There was three other textile artists there that same month, so they called it Intertwined. And I had one section, if you've been in the building, it's an old Carnegie library. So I had the left side half of the room. And so I put up, there was about six large art quilts, and they measure anywhere from 80 to 90 inches wide to 40 to 60 inches high. And I dye fabric. It starts out white. I buy white fabric and I dye it in my outside in my yard. And then I come up with a little sketch. And then the sketch I enlarge on my overhead projector and make a paper pattern. And from that, I have a pattern, the composition for the quilts.
Can you tell us a little bit? You talked about sketching, making sketches. What inspires your sketching for your abstractions?
A lot of the inspiration I get is from the abstract artists from the 1910s, 1920s, 30s in New York City. So people like Mark Rothko or Stuart Davis. So I'll take a piece of paper. I don't draw a lot. My dad did, but I love to cut up fabric and sew and quilt. So I need a composition. So I start with an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper and then just use a regular pencil, a leaded pencil, not a colored pencil, and start drawing shapes and lines. And then inside the shape, maybe I'll divide that shape into maybe triangles or rectangles or squares or petal shapes. Then I do come back with colored pencils and color the composition just on this little 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. Then, like I said, I take a photo of that and then plug my iPhone into my overhead projector. Now I can project that on the wall to, 80 to 90 inches wide in my studio. Then I get out big rolls of paper and pin the paper to the design wall. Then I just start drawing in the shapes that I had, started with the little sketch.
Well, that's very handy that you can just project from your phone.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you something else. You said that you hung some art quilts, and you said the term art quilts. Can you share with us what that means?
Well, it's kind of controversial. Some artists just want to call their quilts art. I still use the term art quilts because a lot of times in Indiana and in this part of the region, people think that the quilts are just for the bed. And so when I refer to art quilts, my quilts hang on the wall. And then it is quilted. I don't hand quilt. I quilt on the sewing machine or a quilting machine. And then with the ribbons, that's my version of applique. And again, they're machine stitched down, one on each side, the left side and the right side.
Okay. Well, for you then, your art quilts, is the intent ever for them to be utilized?
No, they're always hanging on the wall.
Mm-hmm. And can you share with us what appliqué is?
Appliqué is where you take a piece of paper or a piece of fabric and you attach it to another piece of paper or piece of fabric with either glue or stitching by hand or stitching on the sewing machine. So the top, it's usually a motif like a leaf or a heart or a line. My lines are out of grosgrain ribbon. I buy grosgrain ribbon different widths, 3 and 4 inch, 1 inch and half inch widths. So when I applique or attach them to the bottom layer of fabric, you have to, I use the sewing machine, but you can hand stitch.
Yes, I've seen some hand stitched work and I've seen some with the machine. But one thing I don't know, another thing I don't know, I should say, is what is grosgrain ribbon?
Okay, grosgrain, it's a ribbon that's almost like a corduroy. And it's the higher end grosgrain ribbon is called Petersham. It's out of England. I don't know the history. It's been around for a long time. But it has ridges that go the width of the ribbon. And it's almost like a corduroy. It's not flat and it's not satiny. And then it moves. You can form it into arcs or curves by holding one end and putting the iron and making the curve with your hands. And then you press the curve with the iron and it kind of sets it in until I can get it over to the top of the quilt and pin it down. But then I pin about every inch so it doesn't move while I'm sewing it on the left side with the sewing machine. And then not again, then I turn it around and sew it on the right side of the ribbon edge.
Oh, well, I appreciate you explaining that because that really helps me. And right before we started talking on the air, you mentioned that you're doing some work with ACT in Columbus. And can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing with them?
Yes, the owners found me. They have a couple of quilts that I made. They're turning a big building into offices for their employees. And so part of the problem they had is they put glass walls in and wood floors. So when you walk into the office, there's an echo. Mm-hmm. So by putting a rug on the floor, that helps. But then I also made 6 quilts, one for six offices. Then there's a couple of couches in the lobby. So I'm making 1 8-foot quilt for one couch, and then I'm making 5 7-foot panels for the other couch, goes over the couch. And then there's another section of windows. This is 22 feet long. So I'm putting another quilt up there. So it'll be 26 inches high by 22 feet long.
That's amazing. It sounds like it's going to be beautiful and it's going to help them with their sound issues. I really appreciate you spending some time with us today, Darren. Where can we see your work?
I have a website, darrenredmond.com.
Great.
And then the Columbus, Indiana, there's Ivy Tech, IUPUI. There's a building called Columbus Learning Center, and it's out by the airport. There's one of my larger works down by one of the conference rooms. Then there's another one hanging in the stairway. And then there's another work that I made of a big waterfall inside a mountain in Switzerland. It's at Indiana University School of Medicine. It's in the dean's office.
Well, thank you for telling us where we can find you. And thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks, Kara.
Jen, it's time to take a look at all the wonderful things going on in and around our listening area. And you know what? You know it's summer when the outdoor concert seasons kick off. Yorktown will open its concert series Friday, May 30th with the Womblies at 7:30 p.m. The Womblies Rock Orchestra is a 9-piece group, including a 4-piece string section, and they play rock classics and Motown.
fantastic.
It's my favorite time of year.
Yes.
I'm telling you. And then also, the first Muncie Three Trails concert is set for Saturday, May 31st at Cannon Commons, downtown Muncie. Grammy-winning bluegrass band The Steep Canyon Rangers will perform. Mike Martin and the Beautiful Mess will open the show at 7 p.m.
Mm-hmm. The Five Speeds will kick off the summer concert season at Tunney Winery Friday, May 30th. Then the Normal City Slickers will perform there Saturday, May 31st. Both shows start at 7 p.m.
And A.J. Wetzel will perform Sunday, June 1st at Belgian Horse Winery in Middletown. The music there begins at 4 p.m.
Lots of music to choose from. Love that. Nature Play Days kicks off this Sunday, June 1st at Minnetrista Museum and Gardens. Challenge yourself on a nature-themed obstacle course featuring logs, straw bales, and other natural materials. Other special nature-themed events for the whole family are planned through June 7th. Minnetrista.net has more info.
The Brink of Summer Arts Walk is Thursday, June 5th in downtown Muncie. This is one of the big First Thursday events of the year, and it includes a large steamroller printmaking event. Local,
what?
I know, right?
So cool.
Local and regional printmakers will create larger than life prints using a steamroller as a press. That is something to see.
Love it.
Community members can pick and print from pre-made blocks provided. This special event at Arts Walk is hosted by Tribune Show Print. You can also participate in the Downtown Flower Hour, an opportunity to create a bouquet by collecting flowers from 10 different downtown locations. And don't forget Yart, a large original art sale featuring dozens of area artists and makers.
But wait, there's more.
There is.
Yep. You can also catch round one of the Downtown Idol competition. Check out exhibits at galleries and shops. Grab something to eat from downtown restaurants and food trucks and so much more. Brink of Summer Arts Walk is 5 to 8 p.m. in downtown Muncie.
All of that in only 3 hours. What are we doing? Let's do it. All right. Looking ahead to next weekend, Be My Neighbor Day, hosted by Ball State PBS, will be 1 to 4 p.m. Saturday, June 7th at Cannon Commons downtown.
And the first We Fly Fest is set for 5 to 8 p.m. that day, June 7th at Ball State University's Brown Family Amphitheater. Meet Charlie Cardinal and the host of Pop of Culture.
What?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Enjoy lawn games, tour the campus, explore more than 35 tables of activities, awesome swag and info, and listen to the Ball State Studio Band.
They are hot.
So good.
Yeah.
You heard it. Yeah. If you're a regular listener,
right,
you heard them right here on Pop of Culture. More info at bsu.edu/WeFlyFest.
If you have an event that we can cram into this schedule,
yes,
we would love to hear from you at indianapublicradio.org/contact, then click Pop of Culture.
Support for Pop of Culture comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and from you. Become a sustaining member of IPR and support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
And that's our show. Our executive producer is Angie Rapp, and our regular producer is Luke Jones, whose favorite constellation is whichever one he can see from his bed while falling asleep. Also Orion. This week was hosted by me, Jen Blackmer.
And me, Michelle Kinsey. Pop of Culture is a production of IPR on the campus of Ball State University.